Music and culture in Renaissance Europe, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for Music and Conversation, featuring the work of cultural historian Craig Monson.
Mother, don't make me be a nun, since I don't want to be one. Don't cut me out of habit, since I don't want to wear one. All day long in chapel, at vespers and at mass, and the old mother abbess does nothing there but shriek, so let her drop dead. Daughter, get used to being a nun, don't even think of marriage. I'll have a habit made for you.
Cultural historian Craig Monson. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about music and culture in Renaissance Europe. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. During recent years, musicology has moved beyond a traditional engagement with editing, biography, style, and analysis. Scholars are now developing broader, more interdisciplinary perspectives. One of these researchers is Craig Monson, a professor of musicology at Washington University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Monson completed a study of women and music in the nunneries of Renaissance Italy. According to Craig Monson, these institutions represented a primary sphere of female musical activity during the 16th and 17th centuries. They also formed an essential feature in the social life of women during Renaissance Europe. Among his examples is Santa Cristina, which Monson says was the most musically noteworthy of the convents of Renaissance Bologna. He also looks at the life of one of the nuns of Santa Cristina, Donna Lucrezia Visana. We begin with a modern rendition of music typical of convent life in Renaissance Italy. It's entitled Mother. Following it, you'll hear Craig Monson's translation.
Madre, non mi far monaca, che non mi voglio far. Non mi tagliar la tonaca, che non la vuoi portar. Tu tendi in coro, al vespro e dalla messa, e la madra badessa non passe non grida, che posse la crepar. Che fosse la crepa, figlia mi ha fatti monaca e non ti maritar, ti farò fare tonaca, or la voglio portar. Tu potrai sempre star, tu potrai sempre star.
Mother, don't make me be a nun, since I don't want to be one. Don't cut me out of habit, since I don't want to wear one. All day long in chapel, at vespers and at mass, and the old mother abbess does nothing there but shriek, so let her drop dead. Daughter, get used to being a nun, don't even think of marriage. I'll have a habit made for you, so learn to like to wear it. Far removed from every care, you'll be at offices and mass, and there beside the abbess, you'll then be stuck for good.
Craig Monson, welcome to the National Humanities Center. What have we just heard, and what? Tell me about this translation you just read.
Well, this is a late 15th, early 16th century popular song that gives a momentary insight into the plight that faced a large number of women in Italy in the 16th and early 17th century.
Now, you called your project Disembodied Voices. Explain that title to me briefly.
Well, basically, I'm dealing with a group of nuns who were active as performers, but because of the Council of Trent in the 1560s, nuns were increasingly cloistered within the convents. They could no longer come out, they could no longer visit their friends and families, and the walls rose higher and higher around them. They became increasingly invisible to the outside world. Uh-huh. One of the ways the nuns developed to interact with the outside world was through the medium of music.
Are you doing social history, Craig, or is this musical history? I mean, how do you figure out the difference in your own mind as you explain to yourself what you were up to?
Yeah, well, I suppose I don't really try to figure out what I'm doing. I think it's a mixture of music history and social history. Uh-huh. I mean, one of the things I've found out at the National Humanities Center is that I was doing social history. I hadn't realized it before the fact.
Uh-huh. What did, in your research, for example, did you do the music first and then begin to look into the social circumstances? I'm curious about that interplay again.
Well, it was the music that led me to the social circumstances. Uh-huh. I started with the music, was interested in the music, and then that led me into the archives. As it were.
Tell me about the lives that these women led. They are so distant from us in time as well as space. How did you put that together? How do you recover a concrete sense of that sort of thing?
Well, from all sorts of documents, it's a question of taking bits and pieces from widely scattered information. We're dealing largely with women who were from the upper crust of society, the patrician and noble daughters who tended to be dispatched to the convents in great numbers simply to preserve the family patrimony.
Uh-huh. These were women whose lives were planned ahead of time for them, were they not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Most of these women entered the convent before the age of 10. Uh-huh. It was a process called forced monicization. They arranged to have them enter the convent in childhood, where they were frequently raised by their aunts, and then, since this had been the only life they knew, it was natural for them to profess.
Now, what kinds of records did you draw on? I take it that you would have looked at family histories in some fashion or another. You would have looked at diaries, that kind of thing?
If one's very lucky, if one finds that. More often, one's piecing things together from things like the dowry contract, which uh-huh. may say what the family background was like, sometimes from lists of property belonging to the individual nuns.
Now, you look, Craig Monson, at one particular life. This is a woman whose name is Donna Lucretia Orsina Vizzana. Have I got that right?
Yeah, Vizzana.
Vizzana.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you key on that one particular life?
Well, because she was the only nun in the city of Bologna, and I'm working specifically on convent women in Bologna. Uh-huh. Lucretia Vizzana was the only nun out of about 150 composers, singers, and organists in Bologna who actually was so bold as to venture into print and publish a collection of music.
All right. Now, how did that happen? Explain that to me quickly. If that was an anomaly, mm-hmm. how in the world did it take place?
Well, that's one of the things that made it intriguing, because one knew that she entered at the convent at about the age of 8, at a time when it was very difficult for nuns to gain access, at least in theory, to the musical tradition in the outside world. What emerges is that, in fact, she was taught first by her aunt, who was a musician, and then, despite the fact that there were all sorts of prohibitions promulgated by the diocesan hierarchy, she probably secretly received lessons from one of the major composers in the city, and in this kind of roundabout, illicit way, learned to compose, and to compose, in fact, in a style that was more up-to-date, more thoroughly up-to-date than some of her male colleagues active in sacred composition in the world in Bologna.
Craig, give me a sense of the music of Donna Lucretia. We're drawing here, obviously, on modern recordings and reconstructions, but what are we about to hear?
Right. Well, the best way to get a sense of the music is actually to hear a piece. She published a single collection of 20 motets, that is, sacred pieces with Latin text that would find a place in the liturgy. The piece I think it would be useful to hear is a motet called O Invictissima Christi Martyr, O Unconquered Martyr for Christ. And this was a piece that was obviously written for the patron saint of her convent, the convent of St. Christina.
All right. Now, what should we listen for and what we're about?
Well, this is a motet for two solo sopranos and organ accompaniment. And the way it probably would have been heard is out of two windows up near the vaults of the church. On each side of the high altar was a window with an elaborate frame, including the coat of arms of the monastery, so that you have the attention, visual attention, in a way, focused on these windows that then have nothing in them, because, of course, the singers were supposed to be invisible. So in a way, music's own intangibility is intensified by the performance medium. And out of those two windows, then you will hear two sopranos, and one will probably be on one side and the other one on the other side of the church. And they begin separately, and then gradually they begin to call to one another. Mm. And you hear the two voices interacting.
All right, let's listen here.
Okay.
Craig, tell me again very quickly what we have just heard, and then I have a question for you.
Okay, this was a motet called O Invictissima Christi Martyr.
All right, now I noticed that when you were setting up that little piece of music, you used the word probably, the way it probably would have been heard. How do you reconstruct that? How do you figure out what this interplay of meaning and music amounted to in the ears of people then who were listening to this stuff?
Yeah, it's a very complicated situation. One of the big problems is... Well, I said that they were probably singing from two windows separated across the church. Obviously, one of the issues then is, well, how could they manage to sing if they couldn't see each other?
Right.
And it emerges that in the Church of Santa Cristina there were another pair of windows that weren't so visible to the public, through which the two singers could probably coordinate with one another.
You had to get into architectural history here. You had to go back and actually become something of an archaeologist as well.
It's very much like archaeology, except what one is working with is musical documents, archival documents, and trying to piece together the life from all sorts of scraps of diverse information.
Now, who were the audiences for this music in this early modern Christian music that we've been listening to?
The ideal audience in the minds of the nuns were the patrician families of the city. The nuns were enclosed within the convent, had very little direct power of their own, and so what they tried to do was mediate with the outside world, get the outside families to intercede, in effect, on their behalf.
Now, does this have a political function? I mean, is it all sort of sacred and it doesn't bleed over into the secular kind of function of the lives of these nuns? Tell me about that.
It can be quite political. Uh-huh. I mean, the music was a socially constructed medium where words that were ostensibly sacred could still have a secular message they wanted to put across as well. One of the pieces they sang had been dedicated to them, and it uses the well-known psalm text by the Waters of Babylon, but it's constructed as a piece for two choirs. So again, one group would be answering the other from behind grilled windows. And the first choir begins, "How shall we sing unto the Lord in a foreign land?" And then they answer, "In that place those who led us captive asked us of us the words of our songs." So we have these women who are, in fact, led captive by their families into the cloister.
Uh-huh. In other words, you're arguing that the music and the life really were integrated, that the music was not just sort of separate, just something that they did with their left hands or something that occurred only on the Sabbath.
No, it was thoroughly integrated for some of them. I mean, and in fact, in many cases, it created rivalries because the good singers, the ones who connected with the outside world and sort of had an impact in the city, were given special privileges. They were freed, for example, from performing the menial tasks in the convent or the lesser offices.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes there are even cases where they were given salaries. Now, the salary wouldn't amount to much, but it was enough to use for little extra things around the convent, or what pleased the convent most was if you then used that salary to buy something for the convent.
You make me think of that wonderful Browning poem, the soliloquy of the Spanish cloister, the rivalry, the tension between the two monks.
Yeah, that's a very accurate reflection of what was, in fact, frequently going on. In fact, in the case of Santa Cristina, the musical rivalries erupted into a kind of crisis that almost brought the convent to its heels and put them in conflict with the archbishop. Mm. They ended up throwing rocks at the police. I mean, and as one of the nuns said, quote, "It all started because of music."
We all live in a fallen world, huh?
Right,
regardless of
right.
these noble intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Craig, before we turn to another musical example here, your project on music and culture at Santa Cristina, tell me who it is exactly that we're listening to. I mean, obviously, this stuff was not recorded back in the 16th and 17th century. Tell me about these performers that we've been listening to.
Well, the first example, the one that served as a sort of intro, is from a live concert that was done at the University of Pennsylvania in connection with a conference called Creative Women in Medieval and Early Modern Italy.
Uh-huh.
And the singer was Karen Clark Young, singing with members of the Collegium Musicum from the University of Pennsylvania.
All right. Now, the second example, the name you gave it was O Invictissima.
That is a group called Capella Artemisia. Well, the name, I assume, derives from Artemisia Gentileschi, the painter.
Uh-huh.
This is a group of women in the city of Bologna directed by Candace Smith, who is a singer-musicologist. They specialize in the music of nuns. All these performances, by the way, are not studio performances. These were from actual concerts. So they are real rather than perfect.
All right. And what are we about to listen to now? Let's move toward a conclusion of
this
our
conversation. This is a more elaborate piece written by a lesser male composer by the name of Giovanni Battista Cesena from a collection that was dedicated to the nuns of Santa Cristina in 1606. And it's a good example of the more lavish treatment that one sometimes encounters. In this case, what Cesena provides is a piece in eight voices divided into two four-voice choirs. And presumably they would have been spaced out, if you see what I mean, or in a sort of stereophonic effect.
Hmm.
They would have been singing through different grilled windows at the back of the church. The way the piece is constructed, again, is designed to play upon this separation. One group of singers involves sopranos, altos, altos and tenors, and the other one involves low sopranos, altos, tenors, and basses. Now, obviously, this raises a question, how did they get the basses?
Who was doing this?
Yeah, who's on bass?
Right.
And what actually, that was an abiding problem. I mean, the women weren't endowed sufficiently to reach normally into those lower depths, though in fact there was a nun at the convent of San Vito in Ferrara near Bologna who was described as a, quote, singular and stupendous bass. Normally what they had to do is what you'll hear on this performance. There will be a bass viol playing the bottom part, and it's discreetly supports the harmony. You don't really know it's there, but it's providing the kind of fundament underneath. The piece sounds quite complete on its own.
All right.
Another way they often worked it was simply to transpose the music up. Obviously, there are limits in that direction. It can reach excruciating heights at some point.
All right, let's listen. Craig, let's wrap up our conversation about your work on music and culture at Santa Cristina. Let me be whimsical. You have sort of playful ways of referring to this whole enterprise. If you had the opportunity in some sort of musical afterlife here to talk to these women and explore what they did, how they sang, what kinds of points of curiosity do you have?
Well, there are any number. A lot of them are strictly practical. How did you handle the bass part, for example?
Yeah.
I mean, where exactly did you sing? How did you manage to see each other? A lot of them are of a musical variety, that sort of question. But that a lot of other things having to do with the interaction amongst the nuns, particularly at Santa Cristina, where life became for many decades so divisive.
Mm-hmm.
From the outside, it was made to seem as if this was women who simply couldn't manage to get along because they were such intense rivals.
That is such an irony that, I mean, the music has the effect of harmony and piety and Christian love, and yet you are telling me that it was the source of great conflict.
Or it was made to seem the source of great conflict. And this one would love to know exactly what the situation was or what they thought it was. I mean, one of the important uses of music for them was this was this symbol of concord.
Right.
But on the other hand, you have the archbishop saying, in all my time in Bologna, there has been nothing that was so divisive amongst the nuns as the singing of music.
My goodness. Well, Craig Monson, I want to thank you for this lively overview of your scholarship. You have just completed a year at the National Humanities Center, and you've just wrapped up a book on music and culture at Santa Cristina. Does this book have a formal title and a publisher as yet?
It probably has neither at this point.
All right.
It's still in the sort of late formative stages.
Well, I wish you well with finishing this project, and I wish you well as you return to Washington University. Craig, thanks for coming by to be on Soundings.
My pleasure.
Madre, non mi far monaca, che non mi voglio far. Non mi tagliar la tonaca, che non la vuoi portar.
It's Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guest was Craig Monson, a professor of musicology at Washington University. Craig Monson recently completed a study of music and culture in Renaissance Europe. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 671. That's number 671, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week, Gender, the Military, and Activist Scholarship. Listen for Miriam Cook of Duke University and Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College. We'll talk about Miriam Cook's new book, Gendering War Talk. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.